Our next case is A22-1673, in the matter of the welfare of the children of SPD, DPC, and ADB. And once you are settled in, Ms. Carlson, I see you rising. And I know that you both are familiar with the rules of the court, but please state your name and who you represent at the beginning of your argument. You'll each have 15 minutes, and Ms. Carlson, you'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ann Morris Carlson, and I represent appellant mother, SPD. We are asking that this court would reverse the district court's order terminating SPD's parental rights and remand with instructions to reunify the family at the earliest possible time. I am asking for reversal on the basis that the agency did not make reasonable efforts to reunify the family. This is a case where mother didn't reach the same factual conclusion as the court at the time that the court wanted it to. Mother did not come to
the— I just want to make sure I understand, because I thought that you were also appealing each of the bases, egregious harm, palpably unfit, failure to correct conditions, and neglected parental duties.
Thank you,
Your Honor. You are also, it's not just reasonable efforts.
That's not the sole reason that I'm asking for reversal. I'm asking for reversal on several bases, but leading with
reasonable efforts
on the basis that the issue here was mother not recognizing that DCP was a perpetrator of abuse. And
Ms. Carlson, I want to follow up. Like, I had kind of the same question. Are you leading off with that because you believe that's your client's strongest argument? So even if we disagree with you at the statutory basis, reasonable efforts were not successful.
Your Honor,
we're not sufficient.
In all candor, I want her to get her children back. And I know that if this court is to find that there were no reasonable efforts made, that would be one way to get there more quickly. I am asking that this court find that there wasn't a statutory basis, and I explain my reasoning for finding that the court's findings fail to adequately adhere to the findings that are necessary for a statutory basis under Minnesota Statute 260C.301 sub 1B 2, 4, 5, and 6. That there wasn't a neglect of parental duties. There wasn't a palpable unfitness to parent. Mother absolutely complied with her case plan. And the case plan failed to identify the issues that mother needed to address, to do what the court wanted mother to do was recognize that her children were the victims of abuse. And the subtext of this case is that at the beginning, mother was argumentative and challenging. She did not readily accept social services' conclusion that her children had been victims of abuse by someone other than who mother believed was the perpetrator, which was either the foster parent slash daycare provider or someone within that home. Mother felt dismissed by the agency when she brought to them what she believed was a reasonable explanation for the children's injuries.
So you were talking about the case plan that the district court, it does seem that much of the district court's reasoning is that mother failed to really acknowledge that her children were being physically abused. I mean, to just acknowledge the gravity of it and what was happening. But does a case plan have to be that specific? I mean, the case plan said that mother needed to keep the children safe. Is it error for us then to say, well, you know, part of that is recognizing that your kids are at risk? Or are you claiming that if the case plan didn't say, and you need to be able to recognize that they're at risk, that there's something wrong with the case plan? I'm just trying to get at your argument there.
I think the case plan should have been modified. I think that if it was of some import to the agency, that mother have a conversation with her therapist and the social worker so that mother could wrap her head around the injuries that were sustained by the children, that the case plan needs to be modified. The efforts
But they did ask, I mean, they did ask for that when it became apparent that she wasn't getting it. And my understanding of the record was that she declined that.
Yeah, the social worker testified that she offered that. That wasn't a modification of the case plan that was asked by the county. If the county is on their way to termination and they can recognize that the issue that's preventing reunification is that mother isn't grasping the weight of the injuries that are sustained by the children, I don't think that the social worker making one offer to meet with the mother and her therapist, and in that meeting, allegedly, purportedly, attempting to address the fact that the children sustain these injuries.
So what's your best case for saying that a case plan needs to be so detailed and specific and keep being modified?
Well, the
as
efforts
it goes
have
along
to conform.
Beyond kind of saying you need to keep your children safe.
The efforts have to conform with the presenting problem. And if the presenting problem is that mother fails to recognize that her children are the victims of abuse, then I want those efforts to assist mother in identifying that. I'll look to In the Matter of the Welfare of ECS, a case that I was on, where this court found that the efforts did not adequately conform with the presenting problem. Now, that had a different fact pattern, as all these cases do, where mother's rights were terminated in part because she didn't recognize that her children had some developmental struggles. When this court compared the reasons for termination to the case plan, this court found this case plan did not identify or assist mother in understanding that her children had developmental delays or disabilities. It conformed with a number of problems that were relevant at the beginning of the case, mother's use of substances. But by the time the matter made it to trial, the agency was relying on different facts than what the case opened up on. And this court found those efforts failed to adequately conform with the reasons for termination. I believe the same is true here. The efforts put forth by the agency were not efforts to assist mother in understanding what had happened to her children. And there's some subtext here. I don't know that anyone was fully convinced that father was a perpetrator of abuse until he voluntarily terminated his parental rights. There was testimony from the guardian ad litem that she did not know who the perpetrator of abuse was. And
it seems to me that they thought one of the parents was the perpetrator.
And I would say
they leaned much more that way than mother's alternative perpetrator, the foster parent slash friend daycare.
I wholeheartedly agree with this court that no one was in agreement with mother when she gave her alternative theories that it was the foster care provider or daycare provider. And from my perspective, that led to an even greater disconnect between my client and the agency. She believes that she's giving a valid explanation for how the children were injured, and then she also believes that the agency is in cahoots with the foster parent because the foster parent is attempting to cover their own tracks by reporting this to the agency, reporting its concerns about the children's welfare to the agency. And it took a great deal of time for mother to develop a trust. It took time, a new social worker, and frankly, a new attorney for her to develop an understanding of the need to work with the agency if the goal is to get the children returned to her care.
You know, getting to Dad when he did the voluntary TPR, he said that he didn't have stable housing, et cetera, et cetera. He didn't say, I was the person who caused the broken ribs or injuries. So what was it? And even after he did that, my understanding is mother continued to testify as she had testified. It was only on the last day of the continued trial that she said, I now realize, after seeing the x-rays. So I don't understand why Dad's termination on the basis of unstable housing was an aha moment for her.
Well, and clearly it wasn't, and the court took issue with that. I mean, the court took issue with the fact that when father voluntarily terminated mother's parental rights, that wasn't the moment that mother had the realization that I think everyone else in the room had at that moment. That's the way it played out in my mind, is that the rest of us in the room came to the realization that father probably was the perpetrator of abuse, and up until then, I think it had been gray. To me, it's still...
Well, but one of the instances, the mother, her, you know, when she brought one of the children in initially after dad either slammed, which was her original language, down on the bed to the extent that she came in from another room to find out what was going on, or too roughly, whatever her specific language was later. So she saw that. And does she, I don't know. Go ahead. I'm sorry for interrupting.
I'm sorry.
I guess there's not a question in there.
Well, I'll thinking of all these same things. Your point being in citing the case that you referenced, what do you believe the law would have required that's missing additionally for Human Services to have done to more directly steer her? And part of the problem, I assume, is if nobody really knows how it happened, but it keeps happening, would they have to have been honest with her, said, it's him, it's been him, we're convinced it's him, you got to kick him out, sort of a thing? Is that what they should have done? Is that...
To be clear, I don't think that anyone was convinced of that until he voluntarily terminated his parental rights, which was not on the basis that he was a perpetrator of abuse.
That's part of what I'm asking. So then what's unreasonable with what they did if no one knew who did it, but it's still happening, and her obligation is just to assure that it doesn't?
I think the bare minimum they could have done is told her that they've reached the conclusion that he was the perpetrator of abuse. I think that's the bare minimum. I think that she got that information likely from me and the court. I think that was the first that she heard of it.
So is your point, though, you say no one, you think they really knew but never said anything?
I think that through testimony, the social workers did not indicate to her that her relationship with the father was an issue, that her relationship with the father needed to be ended, or that it was ever made really clear to her that the conclusion was it was one of the two of you. If it wasn't you, it was him. You need to choose to stay in this relationship or to care for your children. I understand.
So where should the agency have modified the case plan? At what stage?
I think when mother was not, respectfully, I think we need to give a little bit of credence to the fact that it probably was difficult information to receive. She's a young kid. I mean, she's 21, and she's being given medical information that, even as an attorney, I struggle with processing a lot of the meanings behind diagnostic of child abuse and whether diagnostic is the same as, you know, definitive, whether the medical definition is the same as the legal definition. I struggle with that. And she's... she's got a strong personality that could be a bit off-putting. And she thinks that she knows a lot more than she does. And this was a rude awakening to her. This case, everything... she did a lot of growing up throughout the course of this case. When I think that the agency should have modified its efforts is when, after the dust settled, after the initial dust settled of the children are not in your care, these injuries keep happening, and it has to be one of the two of you... when they were under the impression that mother was not processing that these children sustained substantial, serious injuries, that the case plan should have been modified to give her assistance in processing the fact that these injuries had been the result of abuse, whether that be providing education in the form of this is what child abuse is, this is what it looks like, this is what domestic abuse is, this is what it looks like, assistance in understanding the doctor's orders, coming from someone other than the court and someone other than me. The efforts have to conform to the presenting problem. And the presenting problem, the reason for a termination of parental rights has to be a condition that exists at the time of the trial that will continue into the foreseeable future. The court holds against her that she didn't come around until the last day of the trial. My understanding of the law is that that's enough. She got there. We can't say that when in the foreseeable future she's not going to be able to address the fact that her children were the victims of child abuse when she finally comes around. It should, I would have loved for it to have happened prior to me being assigned to the case. I would have loved for it to have happened long before I met this woman, but that didn't happen. There needs to be a condition that exists at the time of the trial that prevents a parent from being able to care for the child, children, for the reasonably foreseeable future. And I do not believe that the district court's findings of fact or conclusions of law support a finding that this woman would not be able to care for her children in the foreseeable future. Are there questions I can answer?
And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Call, there may be a way to raise this slightly if I...
There is, there are toggle switches otherwise underneath.
Okay. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Tim Nelson. I'm the Chief Deputy Isani County Attorney, and I'm here appearing today on behalf of Isani County Health and Human Services. And just to circle back initially to some of the questions that arose in the earlier part of the argument, as I believe Chief Judge Siegel may have alluded to, the issue was not solely an issue of identifying the perpetrator. In other words, you know, part of the concern here for the agency was about acknowledging the presence of physical abuse at all. And I think that one way to understand the agency's mindset as it begins working with the family in March of 2021 is that there was all of this experience that's covered in the record from May of 2020 through the end of that year. And so at that point, I think the agency would readily acknowledge appellant did many things right. In other words, appellant sees bruising, brings the child to see a medical provider. Appellant sees the father of the children slam, in her words at the time, the child down and brings the child in to the emergency room. Their communications that appellant had at the time with a friend suggesting that appellant understood at that point some gravity of what had happened, indicating that she believed that the father needed to be in therapy on medications in order to be near the child, suggesting that the father shouldn't be around the children until further notice, suggesting again that she grasped at that time that there was a problem and that she had an idea of where that problem was coming from. And then she did voluntarily work with case management over the course of a period of many months. And that work included identifying services for the father of the children, also included discussions about when and how father would be back in contact with the children. Did that again over the course of the rest of 2020. And so the critical context here for March of 2021 includes that, because then what happens in March of 2021 is there's bruising identified that's similar in the bruising to in the bruising that had been identified in May of 2020. There are injuries that are identified that are similar to those that had happened in May of 2020. And they had, again, a parent in the home who had previously voluntarily worked with the agency in a context that suggested some acknowledgement or some understanding of the nature of the issue. And so I think where this case turns then is that over time, it emerges that despite that background and despite reasons to believe that there was that understanding, that this may have backed off or that there may be a different perspective than what they'd observed in 2020 when they'd worked with the family previously. You have initially a refusal to meet directly with the investigator, which of course is a parent's right, but was a different response than what had occurred in May of 2020. You have a letter that's described in the record that's circulated by appellant to the agency, also throughout the community, that I think was received as alarming by the agency in part because the letter purported to explain the reasons why the children were out of the home, but didn't mention over the course of 14 pages that the children had fractures or broken bones. And it was clear that appellant had that information. Now, we can't speak to what she processed or what she understood, but clear that she had that information because the letter itself included what appeared to be snipped out pieces of the medical reports that identified the injury, also the initial child protection petition that described the injuries. Those excerpts were in the letter that was circulated through the community. So it's clear that appellant had in her hands medical reports that the court has available to it in the record, information squarely, clearly identifying that there were these injuries, there were these fractures, and that they were diagnostic of child physical abuse. And then as that emerges as an issue, as the court's referenced, there is the effort by the agency in conjunction with the guardian ad litem, in conjunction with appellant's therapist, to try to confront what they recognized as an emerging discrepancy between appellant's understanding of what had happened, or at least what she was reporting had happened, and what they believed was reflected in the medical reports. And
but
so,
isn't it true that she complied largely with the case plan? I mean, she was seeing a therapist pretty regularly. She was, regularly going to these supervised visits. I mean, she was complying with the case plan. And then it's like, sorry, that's not enough because you're not acknowledging, you know, till the last minute. So, you know, what's the response to that?
Sure. So I think the trial court recognizes, and I think the agency recognizes, that there were a lot of things that appellant did that were, as you say, exactly what was requested. She went to a lot of appointments, engaged in many services throughout. I think for the agency at the end of the day, and I think for the trial court at the end of the day, you know, there is case law quoted in the brief that suggests that it's not enough on its own just merely to have checked all of those boxes. In other words, the fundamental question is whether the parent's able to safely care for the child at that point in time. And so merely to have gone through and checked boxes isn't enough, you know, under our understanding of the law, to be able to say, well, we need to look past or put blinders on to other pieces of the record.
That's at least here today, appellant is arguing, well, then somebody should have told her what else she had to do. If I checked all the boxes, then that's supposed to be enough, I guess. I mean,
sure. And I think, you know, to a question that was posed earlier, the case plan does include the idea that they were to keep the children safe. And so, you know, part of that is recognizing when there are risks to the children. And I think that as, you know, the court has discussed this morning, they made that effort of trying to have that meeting with a therapist, with the guardian ad litem, with the case manager to try to confront that head on and try to ensure that, you know, that basic touchstone, that foundation stone for keeping the children safe, of recognizing that they had been injured. They made that effort to try to ensure that she was processing that and to identify any hurdles or obstacles to that. And I want to make sure I emphasize as well that that also was in a context where it not only was just a single meeting where there was this effort to have this meeting involving the therapist. The child protection proceedings began in court in March of 2021, and the record reflects that from April of 2021 through November of 2021, that appellant repeatedly declined the agency's consistent efforts to try to sit down and meet with appellant in person, which, you know, when we're here after all this is through, talking about, well, what did appellant understand? Were there things that the agencies could have done to sort of help appellant better understand the context, better understand those injuries? They were trying, you know, to sort of sit down with her, be in a room with her, and, you know, try to work through whatever opportunity that presented to get over whatever obstacles there were in terms of understanding the injuries. The other piece that I want to emphasize as well is that it's not in the agency's view, and I suspect in the trial court's view, simply a binary question of did she identify who the perpetrator was, and was she able to sort of chapter and verse identify what happened where and when at the hands of the father of the children. The testimony that the trial court highlights, and I think found alarming, and rightfully in our view found alarming, was that at trial, it wasn't simply, well, I'm not sure about whether it's clear that he did it, or I'm not sure about whether there was some other possibility. She testified that she did not see reason to believe that he would have done this, or reason to believe that there should be some impact on his parenting time with the children. And regardless of what anybody concludes about whether he ultimately did any specific act at any specific time, the record is abundantly clear, you know, in terms of there being reason to be concerned about him, starting first off with the idea that she had witnessed him, in her words at the time, slamming down a child, and that that had happened contemporaneous to when there was suspicious bruising that the Midwest Children's Resource Center identified as also suggestive of child abuse, contemporaneous with when there was the discovery of the fractured rib, which they diagnosed as suggestive of physical child abuse. And then later, there being similar bruising, similar injuries to those children at a similar point in time for the children as well. For each of the children that suffered the fractures, this was in the first months of life when I think people can understand that tension, stress, you know, would be heightened. And so, again, apart from this binary question of was she able to identify clearly this was the person who did this then, to not look at that whole background and say, yeah, there are reasons here to be concerned or reasons here to be cautious or to suggest that there might
Counsel,
be.
Would it be safe to say that the bottom line is the social workers believed it was him? And what I'm wondering is did, and this is part of what I understand Ms. Carlson's point about accommodating, giving it the age, and she's right about some of the medical terminology. Was there perhaps after November when there was finally some conversations that here's the bottom line. He needs to be gone. You need to, well, you can't have him see him and because that's where it's happening. And then that combined with whatever other education, parenting, and therapy that she needs so that it's real clear. And if you don't, here's what happens. That kind of black and white so that it becomes real obvious, which at least she alleges that moment only came on the last day of trial when she looked and the judge found that incredible, I understand. But do you understand my question? Was it specific enough to make that pretty clear so that it's easier for a judge to say, look, it was made pretty clear here, and along with your denials, which we find is ridiculous, it's not that, it's him, and you need to do something about it, really direct.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the issues with taking that clear, and I guess what I'd describe as sort of binary black and white perspective would have been, you know, even in May of 2020, the medical record suggested that, you know, there was bruising that was suggestive of child physical abuse, and that there was the rib fracture that had occurred, which they indicated wasn't able to be precisely dated, but was likely, you know, some time period before the incident that was described as the slamming. And so at that point, you know, I think there was confidence that father had inflicted physical abuse. One background piece here as to the notion of whether she was ever told that he inflicted physical abuse. There was an administrative determination at that time that he'd inflicted physical abuse as a result of slamming down the child. You know, appellant was in a position to be aware of that. But there wasn't, you know, that specific identification of the cause for the rib injury despite the suggestive context. And then when they get to March of 2021, the similar bruising shows up, the similar fractures show up, and in a certain sense, everybody shuts down. You know, there's not the same cooperation with the agency that, you know, that appellant had shown the year before. There's this letter that's alarming, you know, sort of seeming to try to marginalize that there had been, or not mentioning that there had been fractures with the children. And so I think although, you know, the agency certainly looks at the evidence in the same way that the court would have, I think there were concerns about, well, is this clearly 100% a question related, you know, to the father of the children, or is there some broader or more complicated household situation
So can I interrupt for a minute because you don't have a lot of time? I'm sorry. Did he respond to your question, Judge Slater? I didn't mean to be
he was
so
getting,
rude.
I think so, yeah. Go
okay,
ahead.
All right. I'm sorry. So I want to turn to the question of judicial notice. And by the time of the evidentiary hearing, Mom had broken up with Dad. That was over. So if he was the source, he was gone. You know, and she acknowledges maybe at the 12th hour that, you know, that he was the cause and that's a problem. So at that point in time, wouldn't it have been safe for the kids to be returned home? And then we get into this question of judicial notice, where the court says, aha, you know, I know you, and as a matter of fact, I'm going to look up your court file and makes a finding on it.
I mean, I think that my interpretation of the court's order would be that part of what it's looking at is what do we know about appellant over the course of these lengthy proceedings? The court, you know, had a chance to view her testimony three times, and what does that tell us about her protective capacity? And so, you know, I think the trial court took a view that the agency would suggest is reasonable, that that's not a matter of just sort of coming in one day and completely turning the page and wiping away all that the court had seen before that. You know, the October testimony was just a month after the September testimony, where appellants in court testifying that she, you know, is not necessarily convinced that there were physical injuries. She's testifying that she's not seeing reason to believe that the father at that point poses some risk to the children. And I think the trial court goes to some length to explain, you know, its perspective on this, that it didn't find it credible, you know, that what had happened between September and October was a sufficient reason for someone to turn around that way, and didn't believe that it was likely to be sustained in light of, you know, in light of the quickness and the lack of sort of basis for that change in view. I see my red lights on.
Yes, I have one last question. Sure. If we were to affirm, what's your strongest, what do you think is the strongest basis?
I believe that, you know, the pattern of neglect to me would be the strongest basis. I think that, you know, you see this this pattern throughout of failing to recognize risks to the children, failing to process the information that was presented. And something we haven't talked about yet is also the incident in July of 2022.
And we're familiar with the
sure.
record. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Carlson?
As an initial matter, I would disagree. Sorry.
Do you want to lower it?
That's a wonderful idea. Mr. Nelson and I are not similarly heighted if this court has not figured that out.
Lawyers come in all places.
The gentleman might have done that for
Mr. Nelson, you are a perfect gentleman, always have been. My name is Ann Morris Carlson, and I represent SPD. I take issue with a few things that just came up, including the assertion that my client does not believe that the children were injured. I take issue with the court giving any weight to a letter that my client sent in an emotional state to family members and friends that didn't give an entire recitation of all of the evidence that the agency was presenting to the court. She acknowledged at trial that that letter was ill-advised and that it was written when she was very frustrated with the fact that her children had been removed from her care, which I think also goes to why there was this disconnect, why her behavior was different when the agency got involved in 2021 than it was when the agency got involved in 2020. When she went to the agency or you know, acknowledged, I saw this alarming behavior, I think we need some services. When 2021 comes around, she says, okay, I have this figured out, it's the daycare provider. I recognize no one agrees that it's the daycare provider, but she believed it was. Young, emotional, children have been taken away, she struggles with what's happening, and she expresses her frustration in an unsavory manner. I don't think that has anything to do with her ability to care for her children. I think that's just a strong emotional response to a very unsettling series of events. I disagree that she didn't recognize that there were injuries. I would characterize it as that she believed that she knew the source of the injuries and that she didn't. She erred in believing that the agency had some responsibility to prove to her that it was child abuse. It was a contentious relationship once the children were removed. And when it comes to the agency made offers to meet with her face-to-face, the case plan says mother will keep in contact with the social worker via face-to-face meetings, by phone, or text message. She chose email. If the agency wants to meet with her face-to-face, change the case plan. If that's what it's gonna take to develop a relationship, then tell her, tell the parent the change that you want them to make. Be explicit. My client has a high school education, if that. She can't read the subtext of, you know, we're all waiting for this to reach a year so that we can file a termination petition, and we're not satisfied with what you're doing, but we're not going to tell you about that until that termination petition gets served on your attorney. I mean, it's in her mind, she did everything that they were asking her to do and then some. And she did hundreds of hours worth of services for the sake of complying with a case plan that she was told, if you comply with this case plan, we're going to get the kids back in your care. Actually, as it turns out, you complied with the case plan, but what you did wasn't enough for us to be satisfied that you have your children's safety and interests at heart. The agency didn't file a fast-track TPR because it didn't, at the time that the case came in, have clear and convincing evidence that anyone, I mean, it was figuring things out. If it had egregious harm proven at the time that the case came in, then the agency would have been required to file fast-track TPR, and it didn't. I think that the agency needed time to figure out what had happened, and I'm still coming to, I appreciate Mr. Nelson's comments, but still coming to terms with the fact that the agency reached the conclusion that father was a perpetrator of abuse. When, on the record, no. Mother was not told, get father out of your life. Break up with father. He's the problem. Her testimony was that no one from social services ever told her that. And I know that when I told her that that was the issue, that was surprising to her. I understand there's a struggle when it comes to you have a private attorney that is doing your bidding, and then at the 11th hour you get a court-appointed attorney who is going to take a completely different approach. And I'm sorry, I know this is a little bit outside of what's within the record here, but that she didn't have someone telling her this is the way everyone is reading this record, up until the very last minute, up until after father completes his voluntary termination, and then she is told the way this reads to the rest of us is he's been the one that's been perpetrating abuse, and he's voluntarily terminating his parental rights because his number's up. And you can't be with him and care for these children. The efforts have to conform with the presenting problem, and in this case, the efforts failed to address the fact that father was a perpetrator of abuse. May I just finish? That father was a perpetrator of abuse and that mother was expected by the agency to end her relationship with him. I am asking that this court would reverse the district court's order terminating mother's parental rights. She is willing, able, and prepared to have the children returned to her care. She wants that and has been begging for that since the time that they were removed. I am asking that this court would remand with instructions to return the children to my client at the earliest possible time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted, and we'll have our decision out within 45 days. And that concludes this calendar. We'll adjourn to confer.
Please rise.